there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, answers to your questions about all of the above, and your emails as well. So settle down for a nice hour, and welcome. I'll be giving out the numbers in just a moment, but before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's take just a moment and talk about some brief news items. Later on in the program, I'll be presenting an in-depth analysis of a recent, very splashy news story around vitamin E and prostate cancer. So we'll get into a little bit more detail there. But there are a couple of interesting things that I thought were worth mentioning before we go to our first emails. First, this is historical. The California Medical Association, at its annual meeting Friday in Anaheim, I guess this is a week ago Friday now, has come down in favor of legalization of marijuana. Basically, the CMA has said that physicians are put in a very uncomfortable position of having to decide whether they can obey the state law, which allows recommendation for marijuana for medical purposes, and in doing so, disobey a federal law. And everyone's pretty uncomfortable with that option at the CMA level. So CMA is calling for legalization. Very interesting. And I think a little bit historical. Also historical, and this one, good news, there has really been a historical decline in the number of hospitalizations for congestive heart failure. Over the last decade, it has declined 30%, which is a very meaningful number. It's probably saved about $4.1 billion, which is not exactly a bad thing, given the budget issues that we confront in this country. And it is important to understand that congestive heart failure is becoming more and more common during that 10 years. So we really are looking at fewer hospitalizations, even though the number of people who actually have the diagnosis has increased. What does this mean? Well, it means that we've figured out how to keep people out of the hospital, and we've figured out how to catch things early by maintaining a good watch on a person's body weight. The way I always tell patients, if you're gaining a pound a day and your blood pressure's dropping, you're going into worse heart failure, you need to call me. And indeed, weighing yourself daily, if you do have congestive heart failure, is an excellent way to catch the early accumulation of fluid, which after you put on 5 to 10 pounds of fluid is going to back up into your lungs and cause shortness of breath. Catching it early means avoiding hospitalization, and that's a very good thing. Another very interesting news item this week is that in a study done in Africa, there's been strong evidence that tenofovir gel, this is an anti-AIDS drug that was formulated into a vaginal gel to try and reduce the transmission of HIV in Africa, where women often don't have the option of using condoms. Using the gel is something they can do. Well, it did help prevent the spread of AIDS, but it also helped prevent the spread of herpes. In fact, it had 61% less cases of herpes in couples that were followed who used the gel. And it's not FDA approved for this. It was made by Gilead Pharmaceuticals, and they were debating in this release about whether or not they were going to go through the effort it takes to get something approved by the FDA, about 4 years and lots of money to do study. But getting an FDA approval for slowing the spread of herpes could be a major cash cow drug for the company. So, you know, they may decide to go for it. Off-label use is a possibility if the drug can be approved in the United States, even for the prevention of HIV, which it might be able to do. But the idea that we can use an antiviral that was developed for HIV and turns out to work as an antiviral for herpes simplex virus is important and significant news. I'm going to drop into emails now and answer a few. This one from Annie in Santa Cruz. I'm 41 years old and have been diagnosed as being in perimenopause. I'm estrogen dominant. I have endometriosis. And I won't go into the full litany of Annie's problems. She has heavy, painful periods, terrible acne, gets very emotional, lots of bad CMS, lots of depression over the years, and she's tried all sorts of natural cures. I'm dropping in now. About 6 months ago, I started going to a naturopathic physician and started taking an arsenal of expensive supplements, which are not covered by insurance. I'm taking neurotransmitter medication called serine for depression to build up serotonin, and it has seemed to work well. However, it's expensive. I'm also taking 100 milligrams of progesterone from Loudon's Pharmacy the last half of my cycle. Her real question is, she's felt like she initially got better with doing that. Quoting her again, I'm not sure if the initial changes were in my head because I was so happy a doctor took so much time to figure out my issues instead of just handing me an RX and shoving me out the door, but I'm wondering if I would benefit from stopping the progesterone and serine and just taking birth control pills. Annie, in reviewing your case, I think you probably do have a case of Stein-Leventhal syndrome or polycystic ovarian syndrome here. You have the estrogen dominant symptoms, you have the ovarian cysts, and you have the acne. So I would recommend blood tests for DHEA and testosterone. And yes, birth control pills can be used effectively in this population, and it certainly would be worth a try for you to take low-dose birth control pills, but not everyone tolerates them. Another thing to look at, particularly for your acne, is a diuretic called spironolactone, S-P-I-R-O, no lactone. And that will reduce acne by blocking some of the andro effects of the testosterone. So I hope that you will follow up on that. And yes, I think you should give the birth control pills a try. This next email from Mary Beth in Los Angeles. Mary Beth writes, I'm 60-year-old type 2 diabetic with insulin resistant. I'm unable to take glucophage. I take insulin and Januvia, and I'm in fairly good control. I have very good medical care. I also take lisinopril, lovastatin, magnesium, and a little bit of furosemide. Although I'm overweight, I exercise and meditate. My concern is my immune response. I wonder if insulin is seen as a foreign substance and is therefore stressing my immune system. Am I looking at long-term immune system failure with its cancers and other disasters to add to the hazards of diabetes as I move into my senior years? How may I help myself? Well, Mary Beth, the most important thing I want to say to you is that insulin in the forms that we are currently using, which are the cloned human insulins, some of which have been doctored with one or two amino acids to change the molecule slightly to affect the speed of absorption, none of these agents has been shown to evoke an immune response. This is contrary to the old pork and beef-derived insulins, which could create an immune response over time and people would make antibodies to them and the insulin would become less effective. That does not happen with, at least so far, with the newer agents, and I think it's unlikely to happen due to the nature of the immunological response. The most important thing with respect to the immune system, then, is good diabetic control. High blood sugar is an anti-immune drug all by itself. So people who have an elevated blood sugar have sluggish immune system responses, sluggish T cell responses, and that's where the immune inhibition or immunodeficiency associated with diabetes and the opportunistic infections that result arises. So control your diabetes, continue with your drug programs. I have no criticism of anything that you're taking, except that it's important to watch that potassium level if you're taking a little bit of Lasix. That being said, and assuming you're monitoring correctly, I think you're on a good course, and I would urge you not to worry about insulin. Another email, this one from David in Pacific Grove. David wants to know about Coumadin versus aspirin for atrial fib and stroke reduction. He has controlled hypertension and atrial fibrillation, and he switched doctors. And his new doctor has told him that using aspirin alone is not as good as Coumadin for stroke prevention, and that he should go on warfarin. And, of course, our correspondent here is confused. He wants to know, how much of a risk do I have for a stroke, and are the statistics that the doctor quoted me correct? And David quotes 2-3% risk. Let me read you this paragraph because it contains the classic gambler's fallacy. And I want to see if, having told you up front that there's a logical flaw in David's thinking. I want to see if you can catch it. If I recall his numbers, they were something like 2 to 3% risk per year with Coumadin versus 10 to 12% risk with aspirin alone, and the risk is cumulative, which seems to apply that on aspirin, I'm currently about 100% probable to have a stroke in 8 to 10 years on aspirin. This seems to be wildly out of line with the real probabilities of stroke. I'm left feeling I'm missing a parity bit here. Something doesn't add up. And indeed you are, David. This is the classic gambler's fallacy. In other words, if I've been playing dice and it's come up snake eyes six times in a row, the next time it's got to come up a seven because I've run out of snake eyes. And really, that's not how it works. The probability of an event is the same each time you throw the dice. So each year that you live, let's say, without using anything for stroke, either aspirin or Coumadin, each year you live, you have a 2 to 3% probability of a stroke. Then the next year, you have a 2 to 3% probability of a stroke. It is not cumulative in the sense of additive. And so your doctor, if he said that, was definitely mistaken in how the statistics work. That doesn't surprise me. Oddly enough, most of my knowledge of statistics comes from my undergraduate education in psychology and not from anything they taught me in medical school. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if your doctor was mistaken. In general, healthy patients without a lot of comorbidities who don't have a previous TIA can go without Coumadin, and they do run a 2 to 3% risk of stroke every year, probably lower. But again, our studies are large-scale studies, kind of taking all-comers studies. And then if we try to do subgroup analysis, because the frequency of stroke is low enough, the data gets very messy and it's hard to be definite. We do know that in the long run, taking all-comers, it's safer to be on Coumadin to avoid stroke than to be off of it, even allowing for the number of GI bleeds. There are, however, several new drugs. One new drug that's actually been approved by the FDA and a couple more in the pipeline, which are all factor 10A inhibitors. Pradaxa or dabigatran is the one that is currently released, but there's apixaban and a couple of other drugs that will probably be coming down the pike and getting FDA approval over the next few months or possibly 6 to 12 months, basically, I would say, given the timeline for the FDA. These have a lower risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, and they don't require the frequent blood tests that make Coumadin such a resource hog and so annoying. They also don't have the drug interactions and the food interactions that Coumadin has, making them a lot easier to use. So I'm very much looking forward to these drugs, and I think you might consider discussing those with your doctor if you're adverse to the concept of Coumadin. So we had an anonymous email from Florida. I saw your plan for getting off proton pump inhibitors. I wonder if I could do it now. I have limited scleroderma. Scleroderma is a condition, folks, where the subcutaneous tissues become tight like scar tissue. So if you have a scar that on your body that's kind of tight and firm feeling, you can just imagine the entire skin becoming like that. Limited scleroderma means this is only to a mild degree. Many people with scleroderma have involvement of the esophagus, and their esophagus loses its normal elasticity. I've tried betaine before, and it burned both times. I have mild chronic gastritis. The chiropractor thought maybe my digestive enzymes were causing that gastritis, but not because I've been on strong ones for 2.5 years. Tried Reglan and got dizzy and nauseous, so worried that he might still react to Reglan. And the concept here is that this person has heartburn. The major question that Anonymous in Florida has is because they're frequently getting chest pressure and shortness of breath, they are worried that they should not stop their proton pump inhibitor. And I'm inclined to agree. I think you probably are breaking through. And my recommendations for getting off proton pump inhibitors are really aimed at people who don't have a structural abnormality like a bad hiatal hernia or scleroderma, because then you no longer have anatomically normal tissue, and it could be that you do need the drugs and need to stay on them. I think the most important thing to do if you are going to be on long-term proton pump inhibitors is be sure that you take an acidified form of calcium like calcium citrate, which carries its own acid along with it and therefore can be broken down in this digestive system that has impaired acid release that you've deliberately done with the proton pump inhibitor. The other thing that you need to do is either sublingual or injectable B12. And there's really important data that D12 is critical for maintaining yourself neurologically over the long haul. And we have a recent study showing that actual low B12 in just taking elderly people, this was 65-year-old individuals and above, and they were doing brain scans on them. And essentially what they found was that people with the lowest methylmalonic acid, which is the most accurate marker for B12 deficiency, people with high methylmalonic acid, which would be the deficiency situation, had lower cognitive scores at baseline. Over the 5 years of the study, they showed more brain atrophy, and their brains shrank faster than people who were on a higher level of B12 in their bloodstream. So what this means, if we want to extrapolate it, is not only do we have to worry about peripheral neuropathy, but we also have to worry about cognitive decline in individuals who are on proton pump inhibitors. So not just osteoporosis, but cognitive decline. And what can you do about it? Well, you have to replace the stuff that you're giving up effectively when you take a proton pump inhibitor. So I think for individuals like our anonymous writer from Florida, it's important to use the medication, but you have to guard yourself, protect yourself, much like the situations with statins and CoQ10. And we have lots of phone calls, so we're going to jump right to the phones and talk to Robert in SoCal. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
A vascular type question. I've had good cholesterol and blood analysis scores. And the doctor the time before this last, oh man, he said, well, the blood is flowing freely. You're great. The fantastic scores. His word, fantastic. Then recently he was moving the stethoscope up higher around my neck. And he said, well, looks like you can expect a minor stroke sometime in the future, but don't worry about it.
What?
I like this guy, and I think he's a super person in terms of caring about his patients. But I guess I was so shocked I didn't want, and being normally a very inquisitive sort of person, and I was just kind of numb or something.
You had a deer in the headlights moment, is what.
Yeah. So yes, now I'm asking Dr. Don to.
All right. Okay. So what I think happened was that the doctor listened to your neck and heard a whooshing sound, which is called a bruit,
okay,
in your carotid artery or over your carotid artery.
Okay. Okay.
So let's talk about strokes and bruits because there's a lot of misunderstanding on that. First of all, you need to get an ultrasound and see, number one, where it is, and number two, if it looks ulcerated. If you have a bruit in your neck, that's just turbulent flow, and often that can be a minor piece of plaque, not important, or conversely, it can be a very big piece of plaque that has narrowed the carotid artery down to 30% of what it used to be, what it should be. And if you've got that, a 70% blockage, you actually do have a statistical risk for stroke that warrants some sort of medical treatment. If, on the other hand, you have, let's say, a 50% or a 40% blockage, there isn't that much of an increased stroke risk, and the way you manage that is an aspirin and cholesterol control, putting person on either the appropriate diet or even a statin so that they don't grow that plaque any bigger.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. So you don't have all of the information you need to assess your risk.
He did mention a small piece of plaque could break off.
That's true. More commonly what happens in the neck is that the clot ulcerates and raw collagen is exposed to the bloodstream. At that point, the platelets jump on that like a bunch of football linebackers in a pileup. And then you can imagine that football pileup, and then the wind comes along and blows one of the football players off the top of it. That's more the phenomenon. So that kind of plaque ruptures, clot that is soft forms on top of the rupture, and little bits of that clot break off. and go to the brain. And that causes typically a transient ischemic attack, or a TIA. And this is not uncommon. And you usually will have a short-term neurological deficit, like your face will go numb, or you will have slurred speech, or weak arm, and then it comes back. But once a person has had a TIA, that sort of establishes that, yeah, this person really is at risk for a stroke, and we have to do something about them. We don't sit on those.
So how complicated, in terms of getting approval from the insurance company, is the ultrasound?
I don't think it should be complicated at all. Are you under 65?
Over.
If you're over 65, you should have no trouble. It should be a slam dunk. If the doctor hears a brewery, you get an ultrasound.
Thank you, Dr. Dan. You are the greatest.
Well, calm down, take a deep breath, and don't get freaked out, okay?
I will not.
All right, bye-bye. Actually, you know, that's pretty good advice in general when you're talking about these healthcare risk issues. If I had my druthers, I would teach statistics to middle schoolers as just part of their math curriculum. I think we would have a much saner society. I think people would be able to see through the common lies with statistics, and I think people would be a lot calmer if they could engage in a little bit of critical thinking on these numbers analyses. So that's just my view. Let's talk to Bill in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bill, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. What fascinating show. I'm a new listener. I had an experience where I had blood in the urine, and I went to a urologist, and the urologist did a urethric examination, found nothing, and then didn't do anything for 9 months to a year. I then went back to him and said, look, I've still got this blood in my urine. What should I do? And he finally ordered a CT scan, which revealed a tumor in one kidney. I then moved it all to Stanford and found a tumor, which he had not seen, in the other kidney. Now, I have two questions. One is, do you believe there, well, I don't know what you're willing to say, but do you believe there's a problem here? Let's just put it that way. And secondly, if I believe that I should avail myself of an attorney, how do you think I should go about finding an attorney who knows what he's doing? Because, of course, they're going to review the medical facts also, and if they don't think there's a case, they won't take it.
Right, right.
Because I did end up in the surgery. You know, I mean, at least one of them was carcinogenic. I was, you know, I had the surgery. I went through all the suffering of that. And then now we're still watching and waiting the one the guy had originally found, but did, you know, the second one.
And the second one is benign? They've been biopsied and it's benign?
So far, okay. But we're watching.
But it's been biopsied?
No, it hasn't been biopsied. We're watching. We're now doing a CT and MRI.
Okay, so I am thinking that there must be some missing piece of information there as far as the appearance or something clinically about this, the tumor that was found first that wasn't removed, that makes everyone suspect that this is not a carcinoma. And I'm not quite sure what that bit of information is.
So the one that was removed in the right kidney that he didn't see.
I know, that was the carcinoma. I hear that. But in terms of why they're doing watchful waiting on the other one, there's something about it that makes them think it's benign, and I'm not quite sure what that is. But I'm,
because otherwise they would operate right away.
Bingo. So I'm prefacing my remarks with that statement. The workup for hematuria, blood in the urine, standard medical workup for this is, first of all, cystoscopy, looking for bladder cancer. It sounds to me, you said that they looked in your urethra. I'm wondering if they actually looked in your bladder as well.
I haven't seen those records. I can't know.
Right, but
it was just a procedure.
Exactly.
He said it was urethra. I don't know whether, I don't know.
Yes, but you need to pull those records and take a look, because a cystoscopy would be the appropriate thing to have done. A lot of people have blood in their urine and it isn't from a cancer. And there are a couple of cancers that are common, like the cystoscopy, the ones in the bladder. So you generally check for transitional cell cancer of the bladder. And you look in the urethra, and of course, in doing that, you've also gone through the prostatic urethra and visualized that. So if there's a prostate cancer that's eaten into the urethra, that should be visible as well. That, by the way, is a fairly rare thing for prostate cancer.
Yeah, I already had prostate cancer, radiation, brachytherapy, and hormones 4 years before.
Okay, so that also gives us another reason why you could have blood in your urine from urethral damage from all of that therapy, such that now you have sort of an irritated urethra that bleeds. I don't believe that anyone considers it to be the standard of care medically to do an abdominal CT if you've got mild hematuria and a clean cystoscopy. You often just put it down to benign familial hematuria. So we don't usually check the kidneys. In children we do, because there are a few nephroblastoma and Wilms tumors and things like that that show up in childhood. But adult kidney cancers are sufficiently rare that I don't think your doctor violated, not a urologist, but
right.
from a primary care standpoint, I don't think he violated the so-called standard of care.
What was shocking to me was that when I went to the library, the cancer library of the hospital, I picked up a book on kidney cancer, and it said that the single symptom, the most common symptom, was blood in the urine.
Well, yes, but that's the most common symptom of kidney cancer. On the other hand, blood in the urine is rarely kidney cancer. It's usually something else. So you have to flip that logically.
I see. So
most of the time, it's
it
not.
May not it, you're saying it may not be the standard of care to check for kidney cancer because it is a symptom of kidney cancer.
It's also a symptom of a heck of a lot of other things which are much more common.
And isn't the fact that he ordered the CT scan indicative that he knew there was a kidney problem?
No.
Why would he order it? I mean, I just went in and said, look, I've still got the blood. What do I do?
Well, I have a feeling it was a fishing expedition.
Okay.
With the idea that, and I'm, you know, I'm inferring this.
Right,
but
it can't have
patients,
hurt anything.
Yeah, exactly. Patients, well, you could argue that the radiation dose from the CT scan is high enough that you don't want to just do that lightly. You know, and I would make that argument. I don't think that people should get CT scans of the abdomen just in case they might have something. You need to be suspicious, more deeply suspicious, before you go and do that test.
And can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
If I've had radiation and I leave the radiation room when he's done with the cancer doctor for the prostate saying, okay, now you've had as much radiation as you can have. And then later I get these CT scans and MRIs and all this stuff. Aren't I going beyond whatever it is I'm supposed to have?
A different kind of radiation.
Okay, it's irrelevant.
Well, the type of radiation that we use in cancer therapy is stronger, and we do have lifetime limits on what we think is safe to do.
Uh-huh.
Okay. On the other hand, when you do X radiation, there can be DNA damage from it, so we don't like to do a whole bunch of it all at once. But the lifetime risk, it's apples and oranges, basically.
Okay, so the fact that I'm now having, for the other tumor, or worry tumor, a CT and an MRI is not a cause for worry?
No, it wouldn't be a cause for worry for me for that.
Okay.
Just the general cumulative radiation from too many CT scans close together may not be such a great idea. But it sounds to me like you have got, you know, some major issues here as far as your waterworks system is concerned, you know, the kidney tumors, one kidney carcinoma, prostate cancer. So I can see why someone might not immediately jump to an abdominal CT. On the other hand, I can see why if you end up at a tertiary medical center like Stanford, they're going to do that.
Right.
And, you know,
thank you very much for your help here.
Your other question about finding an attorney?
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that's a good question because there's a lot of ambulance chasers out there.
Yeah, I had no idea how to look for one who was any good and really knew what he was doing.
Yeah, and I think that the place that I would start would be the County Bar Association. They will have lists of doctors who do medical malpractice, which is the kind of lawsuit you're looking at. And you can look at people in terms of, you know, what cases they've done. I would tend to shy away from attorneys who have been involved in large class action suits, because that's where the real serious money is, and so that's
right.
Where the real serious money grubbers go.
Right.
And people who do individual case medical malpractice
would be more likely to be appropriate.
I think so. And I think I would talk to the County Bar Association, get some recommendations there. You know, a lot of it's feel. You want to look at their case record, you know, what's their win rate versus their settle rate and things
right.
like that. You can get that information from the offices.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Bye.
Bye. Let's go to Harry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Harry, and welcome to the program. Hi.
I'm 48 years old,
uh-huh.
and I'm calling because I'm experiencing numbness in my right thigh. And it appeared about 2 months ago after a backpack trip.
Mm-hmm.
And that was associated with pain, of a stabbing nature, almost electric-like, which makes me think of nerves.
Right.
The pain has subsided, and the numbness has gone away. But now I have another spot of numbness on my left jawline, on my neck.
Oh, okay. Well, this went to a completely different direction than I expected. Let me start with, define the area of numbness on your neck, on your jawline. Is it on your neck or on your face?
It's on my neck, just below my jawline, the size of a silver dollar.
Okay. You found that probably from shaving, altered sensation.
Yeah, it's really strange to shave.
Yeah. Okay. Because that's, I would doubt that I would notice the numbness in that area on myself, but.
It's definitely notable.
Yeah. Okay.
And running my finger down vertically from my ear, I hit a nerve that twinges a sensation in that numb area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you think of any trauma or helmet strap or some kind of physical object that pushes against the area, the general vicinity?
I do wear a biking helmet, bicycling helmet, and it's never given me trouble before.
Yeah, okay. So I'll tell you what I think is going on. This is kind of an interesting phenomenon. But when you were backpacking, I think that you mashed your lateral femoral cutaneous nerve, which goes through your groin and comes out to the anterior thigh. And it might have been the belt, the backpack, you know, hip belt and climbing or something where you just put too much pressure on this nerve. We see the phenomenon most commonly in the 8th and 9th month of pregnancies. It's very common for the baby to push on the nerve, and then the woman will develop numbness, tingling, and sometimes sharp shooting pains in the front of the thigh. That's called Meralgia Paraesthetica, M-E-R-A-L-G-I-A, if you want to look it up. And I think that's what you had, and it did what it's supposed to do, which is recover after several months.
And that's associated with pain?
Yeah, it can be, for sure.
Okay. Now, outer right thigh.
Yep, exactly. Now, or either thigh, it doesn't matter what side. So that's probably what that was, and now you've got something else on your neck, and arguably it's from your bicycle helmet strap pushing on the nerve where it comes out. Now, the fact that lightning has struck twice in the same body, as a functional medicine doctor, I'm thinking, I wonder what's wrong with his nerves, that they're so vulnerable to compression neuropathy. And I'm thinking, I want to check the B12 level and the methylmalonic acid and the homocysteine, and I want to look at vitamin D. I want to see if there's something about this guy's physiology that's making his nerves more vulnerable. So I would get at least that basic workup that I've just mentioned, and you can go to the podcast, which will be up by next Friday, to hear the show again to get those specific tests.
Okay.
Okay.
I didn't mention that I have a low back pinching pain, too, that I've ruptured, I think, a disc, but I don't feel it is associated for some reason.
Well, I think that...
Not like a sciatica pain in my thigh.
Right. Well, if something's pushing on the nerve, whether it's a disc or a strap, is the nerve more vulnerable than the typical person that you'll have a lower threshold for getting these problems? That's the question I'm raising.
Right.
I would change my bicycle helmet, pad the area where the strap goes, get a piece of foam and attach it to the strap so that there's not so much direct pressure under and around the ear.
Okay.
All right.
Go.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's talk to Sasha. Hello, Sasha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling with regards to my husband. He's got a frightening thing that's been bothering him for about 6 weeks now. Let me preface by giving you a little bit of a background. 3 years ago, he had surgery for nasal and sinus polyps. During that time, his ENT had him get about 3 to 4 head CTs within about 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, about 6 weeks ago, he started experiencing some strange joint pain in his hands. Then he started that progressed into tingling in his hands and arms and legs. He had kind of a fuzzy head and these kind of trembly feelings in his muscles, although they weren't visible.
Mm-hmm.
He got a lot of anxiety from this and went to see his general physician. She wasn't able to find anything. She did refer him to a rheumatologist, and a battery of tests were taken. Nothing showed up on any of his tests. He's now 6 weeks later. He's still having the symptoms. They seem to come and go episodically. And he also now has insomnia. He can't sleep at all at night without taking Ambien or lorazepam, I think is what it's called. And he also has severe ringing in his ears.
Okay. So did the ringing in the ears come later, or was that an early manifestation when this was first getting started?
It was later. So the whole thing's been going about 6 weeks, and the ringing in ears has only been about a week and a half, 2 weeks.
Is he taking aspirin?
No.
Okay. Because ringing in the ears, aspirin toxicity, that's like right out of the box, first thing.
Okay.
Your unasked question there was, did multiple head and face CTs somehow cause brain damage or set him up for something that could be manifesting like this? And while you didn't ask that question, I've heard it. So I want to answer that one and say, no, I don't think so. As far as the symptoms are concerned, it's really a chicken and the egg situation, because the anxiety could actually cause all of the physical symptoms you list, including, for that matter, the ringing in the ears. The way that the ringing in the ears is manifested is the person is tensing their jaw and neck muscles subconsciously, mm-hmm. and that can, in some individuals, actually trigger ear ringing. Those people will generally be the ones whose ear ringing gets better with chiropractic manipulation, which is not the majority of people with ear ringing, but I throw mm-hmm. that out there. As a primary care doctor looking at that, yes, I would do a rheumatological workup. I would also probably do a therapeutic trial of an anxiolytic. I'd put the person on Valium or Ativan, probably a longer acting low dose benzodiazepine, and have them track their symptoms, because I would be concerned that the anxiety was driving most of the symptoms rather than the other way around. And people can develop anxiety with physical manifestations without really being in touch with the fact that they have anxiety.
Right.
Or feeling like there's much going on in their life. Sometimes this just gets started and it's a self-perpetuating thing. That would be one of the early steps, because common things are common and rare things are rare. Where to go next? We've got a negative rheumatological workup. You've got really, I'm assuming, a normal neurological exams. No actual physical manifestations of asymmetry in terms of sensation. If the fingers are tingling, you know, you check for carpal tunnel, because that's another common one. You check for nerve entrapment in the neck, nerve entrapment at the elbow, because all of these can cause finger tingling. And, you know, the pattern of the tingling is different depending on where the entrapment is. So there's more work to be done here on that symptom. But I think the first thing I would do at this point, before doing any more major testing or imaging studies, would probably be a trial of anxiolytics to see if the symptoms reduced with that. And of course, the insomnia fits right in there.
Okay, great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So
we'll talk there about it.
Hopefully it's a mind-body issue, and if we calm the mind, the body will follow along. Now, let's suppose that the Valium does work and the symptoms evaporate. You can't be on Valium forever, so you have to use either other anxiolytics that aren't so habit-forming, and maybe start doing some objective stress reduction work. You're not done if you establish it. You then have to figure out how to undo the feedback loop that's set up and causing mm-hmm. the problems. The ear ringing is a little bit interesting. It makes me want to be sure he's had an appropriate metabolic workup. You know, check for diabetes, check for thyroid, things like that.
Okay.
And of course, get a hearing test too. An acoustic neuroma, which would be typically cause dizziness as well as ear ringing, would not have all of these physiological manifestations generalized, but it has to be thought of. You know,
right.
if there was a brain tumor, the ear ringing brain tumor thing of acoustic neuroma would be where I would look for that.
Okay. Okay, great. Good to hear.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. We had a call from Georgia in Santa Cruz. Says that all the symptoms that the woman described for her husband, anxiety, ringing in the ears, are what people are having after smart meters were installed. And I do want to say that's an interesting observation. Of course, there's a lot of anxiety around smart meters. And I did a analysis of the physics and really looked into that a couple of months ago. There's a show in the archives where we discussed the smart meter issue at length. To cut to the chase, I think if you're more than 5 feet away from your smart meter, that it's very unlikely that it can have a direct physical effect on your brain. Whether the proximity of the smart meter can have a direct effect on your brain through the thoughts you think about it, I think, however, is indisputable. So this is one of those issues where I'm going to come down in favor of I don't think the smart meters are a problem. I really don't. And I think that there's a lot of anxiety and groupthink and sometimes some mass hysteria going on issues. And that doesn't mean that the physical symptoms aren't real and they don't need to be addressed with kindness and compassion. One of the things I will condemn medical doctors for commonly is that they don't offer an alternative. The rheumatologist says, well, your problem's not rheumatological. I'm done. Well, to a person who's suffering, that's really not useful, doctor. What you should be doing is saying, it doesn't seem to be in my area, but this might be a fruitful area for you to explore. And then this includes, look, you know, I don't think that your symptoms are related to a physical illness. At least I'm not able to find a physical illness. But like I suggested to the woman who called in with the husband with those symptoms, a therapeutic trial of an anxiolytic to establish whether or not relieving anxiety relieves the physical symptoms. And if so, that points you in the direction of working on the anxiety as a way to alleviate the physical symptoms. That's a really meaningful and compassionate kind of bit of advice that I think we should be doing if we think that's what's going on. And yes, sometimes the patients will get insulted. Oh, you think it's all in my head? But it all depends on how you say it. If you say it in a way that is compassionate and offers an opportunity to prove or disprove the assertion. I haven't had patients get huffy or, you know, fire me over that. It really is important to try to offer people options and not just leave them high and dry with a, oh, well, I can't find anything wrong with you. I need to take a moment and do what I promised, which is give you all of that info I promised around the vitamin E and prostate study. Now, it was a big splash a week ago in the news. Vitamin E increases prostate cancer risk. This study is like the one I talked about last week. It's meaningless, okay? It's a statistical fluke. It's badly designed, and they broke the basic rules of statistics in how they did this. But they managed to get something statistically significant that they could publish, which unfortunately is a problem. We have selection bias at the level of the journals. In other words, people only want to publish positive results, so statistical significance is what lets you get published. We also have selection bias in terms of the profession. Scientists with lots of papers tend to get better jobs and tend to get more grants. So publishing everything you can, anything you've got that's publishable, you publish, whether or not it's clinically meaningful, again, is a bias that drives some of this. Let me just start with the study. This was a study that was not actually set up. It was the SELECT trial, S-E-L-E-C-T, and it was not really set up to look at vitamin E alone. It was really set up to test the idea that selenium, with or without vitamin D, might be helpful. And there's some real flaws in how they set the study up. They had 35,000 men. That's a lot. Anytime you have a large number, you're going to have a tendency to exaggerate statistical flukes and make small differences that aren't meaningful medically look meaningful statistically. And I think that happened in this study. This group included people in the United States, Canada, and Puerto Rico, and that's very important. The study looked at four treatment groups: placebo, selenium only, vitamin E only, or selenium plus vitamin E. After about 3 years, they weren't seeing an improvement in they weren't seeing a difference with selenium and vitamin E. And they did their analysis and they said, you know, it's going to be pointless to continue the study because we aren't seeing a benefit. We probably won't see a benefit at 7 years. So they closed down the study early. And that's something that bothers me a little bit, because if you change course in midstream after you've already designed your study, then you really have to watch what you do with that data and what conclusions you draw. Personally, given that we know that a prostate cancer is going to be present, let's say in 1990, the first cell becomes cancerous. Because of the slow growth rate of most prostate cancers, it's going to be 5 to 10 years before any measure can detect the cancer. So if you know that, then running a study for 7 years gives you very little chance of detecting a difference, because you want to know whether or not you're preventing prostate cancer or speeding up its growth. You have to have a detectable cancer in order to be able to answer that question. And this study was too brief to answer that question. But in doing that, they did say, oh, well, look, this group, the vitamin E only, has a trend to higher cancer rate. So in 2008, they stopped giving everybody selenium and vitamin E, but they kept in touch with the group of people who had been in the vitamin E only cohort, and they followed them for another 3 years. And the early trend towards more prostate cancer in that group continued, and you ended up with more prostate cancer in the quote-unquote vitamin E group. But the thing that none of the news stories said was that they stopped taking vitamin E 3 years prior to this data collection. So attributing this difference in cancer rates to vitamin E, to me, seems ridiculous, for one thing, unless you're postulating that the vitamin E actually gave them cancer. Another flaw with this study was that the second group, the selenium plus vitamin E group, did not have any increased risk of cancer. So how can you make that statement? You know, selenium alone had a trend towards increased cancer. Vitamin E alone had a trend towards increased cancer. And selenium plus vitamin E did not have a trend towards increased cancer. And these trends were not statistically significant in the study. They had to doctor the data seriously in order to achieve statistical significance. And they did it in a way that makes absolutely no sense from the standpoint of attributing the difference in cancer rates to vitamin E. I think this was a failure in randomization. And I think they broke several basic rules of statistical analysis in setting it up. And my advice to those of you who are taking vitamin E is take a mixed tocopherol. Don't take just alpha tocopherol, 400 units. Take a mixture of alpha, gamma, delta, and the other tocopherols, because you need balance with your vitamin E. Better yet, take a couple of tablespoons of wheat germ a day and call yourself done. We're going now to Mark and Salinas. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I'm 61. I wear glasses, and they have all the bells and whistles, non-glare and transitions and all that treatment. But I've noticed recently, during sunsets only, that I start to see a bit of a glow around the edges of the mountains. It looks like, the only thing I can say, it looks kind of like an aura. And recently a bell went off in my head, a warning sign. Oh, that might be a warning sign for some sort of damage to your eye, some sort of like macular degeneration or something. Is it just an effect of my glasses and I never noticed it before, or do I need an eye check?
When you're driving at night, how do the oncoming headlights look? Do they have a glow too? Or do they have like a star filter?
No, I haven't seen that.
All right, look for that carefully. If you're seeing like that star prism effect that photographers use sometime, mm-hmm. that would be suggestive of cataracts. The glow is probably chromatic aberration in the lenses, but it could also be very, very early cataracts.
Okay.
So I would get the eye check. You're over 50. You should get your eye pressures checked annually. There's a lot of people who lose vision from glaucoma, which is clinically quite silent. This aura that you're describing is not a classic glaucoma finding.
Okay.
So I'm not so worried about that. But if your eye pressure is elevated, it changes the refractive quality of the vitreous, and you might get some kind of aberration like that. So I do think eye pressure and a dilated exam to look at the cornea are indicated.
And annually is enough for that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
And I really appreciate what you said about statistics in school.
God, I wish.
Yeah, and I heard that on a TED Talk, too, so I think we're in good company.
I would love to see it. They're learning percentages. Teach them odds. Teach them about standard deviation. Mm-hmm. They're doing science projects. I mean, it's really a good moment to try and reach that population. But
it would defend them against conspiracy theories, too, I think.
It would defend them against a lot of nonsense. And I think as we enter into the age of the internet, where there's a lot of people claiming to be experts out there, and not all of them actually have any expertise, but some of them are very convincing.
Right.
We really need to be able to think about data for ourselves, because we can't rely on the people in the white coats anymore.
That's true. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
We've got a couple of minutes before the end of the program, and I've got a couple of quick news stories to read. So let me start with this one. MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, is a big problem in hospitals, but it's also become a problem in the community. Analysis of the issue shows that somewhere between 1 to 2% of the population, at least 2.5 million persons in the United States, are nasal carriers asymptomatic of MRSA. In this study, a very complex database was explored, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and they looked at the relationship between the consumption of coffee, tea, hot tea, cold tea, and soft drinks to see whether there was any difference. And the idea, the hypothesis here was that, well, coffee and tea have antibacterial properties. Would consuming them allow for the reduction of MRSA carriage in the nose? And it turns out that indeed it does. Individuals who drank as little as one cup of hot tea per month were 50% as likely to have MRSA in their nose as individuals who drank no hot tea. The same thing was true for hot coffee, 50% reduction in the risk of nasal carriage compared to those who drank no coffee. They did not find any difference for cold tea or for soft drinks. And an interesting little tidbit in this study was that in doing it, they had a really hard time finding anybody who didn't drink soft drinks. In other words, to fill the group that had no soft drinks, they couldn't find enough people in this huge population study who never drank soda. Pretty much everybody in the survey drank soda at least once a month. I find that amazing because I never, ever drink soda. Haven't for years. So it just amazes me how widespread that particular practice is, particularly in the light of the data we have about how bad sodas are for you. We have time for just one more quick story. This one is about the Accountable Care Organization regulations. You know, this is the healthcare reform topic. And the HHS released their final rules for Medicare Accountable Care Organizations the other day, and they made it simpler. In fact, they removed the electronic health records requirement. This is huge, and I think a huge surprise to anyone in the medical world, particularly if you're involved in hospitals, because we've all been assuming that the computerized medical record would be an ongoing requirement for the participation in these accountable care organizations. So for those of us in the medical world, this is quite a surprising bit of news. For those of you who don't care, well, I had to fill that last 30 seconds. I hope you've enjoyed this program. I've certainly enjoyed talking with you and reading your emails, discussing the science and the statistics. So I hope you'll tune in next week. And until then, so long and stay healthy.